I've plotted your course along the Izu Trench, Jason. We should be roughly off the coast of Iwo Jima within 3 hours, traveling as we are.
Terrain following was the only way with the people we're carrying, Sebastian. If the Russians on the surface have any means of communicating with our underwater variety, everybody and his brother would be looking for us by now. And if we stick to the volcanically active areas so we can mask our sonar profile, well...
Every little bit helps.
Darkwood nodded to Sam Aldridge, the Reagan's head of security.
Right.
I'm gonna help myself to some more of your coffee.
The Marine captain looked at Darkwood, then at Sebastian.
You want any more coffee, Mr. Sebastian?
No, thank you, Captain Aldridge.
Aldridge shrugged his shoulders.
I know what I want.
Darkwood checked the dual-display analog-digital Steinmetz on his left wrist.
Hey, you're still on duty, Sam. Come to think of it, we all are.
If I may, Jason, why are we making our way toward Iwo Jima?
I hate to second Mr. Sebastian in anything. Well, that's a damn good question, Jason.
The coffee mug was steaming, and Aldridge set it down.
Well, I wish I could give you guys a damn good answer. But all I can say is that it's for a good reason. And it'll take some of the heat off our backs a bit. Maybe. I'd tell you both if I could, but I'm under orders not to discuss Iwo Jima, so I won't discuss it. Suffice it to say, if something were to happen to me, Sebastian, you'd find things concerning Iwo Jima in my safe. And then?
Darkwood grinned at his friends.
You could pester him, Sam.
Hell of a lot I'd get out of him.
Aldridge gestured toward Sebastian. Sebastian stood up, setting down his coffee cup and rubbing his hands together as if they were somehow cold.
I intend to pass by sickbay to check on the health of our passengers. Is there any message you might like me to convey to Dr. Barrow?
Tell her I'll be there.
He looked at his watch again.
In an hour. Thanks.
I got a boogie too, Jace.
Aldridge took one sip of his coffee, scowled, then followed Sebastian out. Seeing T.J. Sebastian and Samuel Bennett Aldridge together was a relative rarity, unless the matter were duty-related. One of the reasons Darkwood had his end-of-watch coffee sessions when circumstances allowed. One of the other reasons was that both men were his best friends, and had been as long as he could remember. The Sebastian-Aldridge feud, if it could be called that, was based on one of the incontrovertible facts of life in Midwake. The black community, over the centuries of life beneath the sea, maintained much of its original racial integrity, hence it had a restricted gene pool. The same could be said of many of the ethnic groups within Midwake society. Genealogy was a common passion in Midwake and a necessity to prevent close relatives from marrying. Someone started a rumor that Sebastian and Aldridge were cousins. Sebastian was quiet, reserved, had an academic record that qualified him to teach at the Naval Academy. Aldridge was a wild and crazy Marine, although no less academically gifted. So began the feud, or whatever it was, both men deeply respecting each other and each other's abilities, both men committed to the survival of Midwake, but both men, and in fairness particularly Sebastian, resenting the insinuation that they were relatives to a degree that bordered occasionally on petulance and childishness. The situation was silly, Darkwood knew, but life frequently was. Jason Darkwood set down his coffee cup, in the mood for something stronger, as Aldridge suggested. He crossed his cabin, which didn't take a great deal of walking. Space on board a submarine was always limited. He studied the map of the known world. It was a hologram. When viewed at one angle, it showed the world as it had been 5 centuries ago, before what Dr. Rourke called the Night of the War. When viewed from the other angle, it showed the Earth as it appeared today to the best of the knowledge of Midwake cartographers. One of the 50 United States was all but gone. Much of what had been California fell into the sea that night when the concussion from the bombings and missile strikes collectively shocked the geologic fault line and the tectonic plates separated. It was called the San Andreas Fault. He remembered that from a history test he'd almost failed in grammar school. Part of Florida, where there had once been a peninsula, fell into the sea. No one knew the reason.
Maybe I should ask Annie Rourke.
Apparently, though, Florida fell away sometime between the bombings and when the atmosphere ionized and most surface life was incinerated. Many islands vanished below the sea, while some new ones surfaced. Perhaps old islands that had sunk once before in the geologic epoch since the Earth began. His eyes settled on an island that had neither risen nor sunk beneath the sea, Iwo Jima. Iwo Jima was, of course, steeped in the history of World War II, but whatever might have remained to remind the people of future years of this war had long since been washed away in the unprecedented tsunamis that swept virtually every island and coastal area in the Pacific Basin when California fell into the sea. Aboard the Reagan, Darkwood was the only person who knew the current status of Iwo Jima as a top-secret training facility for a group of men whose very existence was only rumor, the Special Warfare Group. The Special Warfare Group, or G's, as they called themselves, consisted of volunteers from both the Navy and the Marine Corps. Military Command accelerated their training program after Midwake's first encounter with the Rourke family, the reason for their inception that much more important. For some time, under the leadership of Jacob Fellows, president of Midwake, Admiral Ron, chief of naval operations, and General Gonzalez, commandant of the Marine Corps, quietly siphoned away some of the very best men in both branches of the service. Darkwood originally learned of the program when General Gonzalez tried to hire off Sam Aldridge. Aldridge was originally tapped for one of the G's leadership positions until he was lost to the Soviets during a commando raid. Admiral Ron designed the operation with the goal of infiltrating their submarine pens to gather intelligence on the unification of Soviet nuclear technology and their island-class submarine fleet. Aldridge was presumed dead until he and his team were helped to escape by John Rourke. At the conclusion of Rourke's battle with the Soviet surface commander, Vladimir Karamazov, Sam Aldridge was offered the job again. He refused, feeling he could do more as part of the Corps rather than training for a war that was not yet to be fought.
But who knows?
However, that was the crux of the logic behind the creation of the Special Warfare Group, that a land war with Soviet forces was inevitable. To prepare for that day, a small group of highly trained special warfare personnel had to be ready to respond to the first wave, then form the nucleus around which a larger United States land force might be formed. The G's lived and trained principally on Iwo Jima. Without orders, he was proceeding there now. It would have been possible to work a radio relay through the system of communications buoys, perhaps, but such a radio message might well be intercepted. From what little Annie Rubinstein said when she came aboard, the land-based Soviet Empire was embarked upon an offensive of unprecedented magnitude. If this were in some way connected to the Soviet forces beneath the waves that Darkwood and 5 centuries worth of Americans from Midwake fought, the information was too valuable to risk sending to Midwake by conventional means. The link between Iwo Jima and Midwake was a laser optic cable, its security unquestioned because to tamper with the cable's armoring would automatically sever the communications link. He was violating security to preserve security. The shape of Iwo Jima, as well as its size, altered several times over the 5 centuries since the night of the war. A large lagoon, deep enough for a careful submarine skipper to enter and exit, lay on the east side of the island. The G's base was somewhere inland. Finding it was the quickest way to notify Midwake of the Soviet surface offensive and consult with naval operations concerning the possibilities of somehow contacting Dr. Rourke concerning his daughter's survival. He tapped his finger against the holomap, then looked at his watch. If he didn't want to be late for Margaret Barrow, he'd have to set a new speed record for paperwork. Due to the destruction caused by the Soviet invasion of the first city and the Soviets' subsequent withdrawal, the chairman's office was one of the few places where they could be alone. Still, one thing never seemed to change in Sarah Rourke's world: her husband's sense of his ultimate rectitude.
John,
I love you, and I don't want to lose you and the baby. What could be simpler than that?
He leaned against the chairman's desk.
John, she's my daughter, too. And anyway, there's no place on Earth that's safe. We both know that. You should be happy. After all these years, I finally understand why you are the way you are. If something's right, you do it. And damn the consequences, personal or otherwise. Now that I understand that, agree with you philosophically, you try to turn it off.
I'm glad you realize what you realize. I'm glad you feel as you do. But then you have to understand why I feel as I do now. I don't see any rational reason why you should insert yourself and our unborn child into a situation so fraught with peril. I think I know what's right, and as you implied, I should damn the consequences.
She suddenly felt tired and sat on the arm of a black lacquer chair.
So, what you consider right is more right than what I consider right? That's ridiculous.
You are going to have to abide by my decision because I feel it's right for all of us, not just for you. I don't want anything to happen to you, period.
John Rourke always stated his case, but he never argued in the way that most people think of arguing. He was always so calm, never fought. She fought.
Why did you make me pregnant?
Sarah watched his brown eyes. There was no flicker of hesitation when he answered.
I wanted to make love to you. Sort of like you said a moment ago, damn the consequences. I'm glad you're pregnant.
She said it and felt guilty the moment she began to speak.
Now that I'm pregnant, fine, I can't do this, can't do that because of the welfare of the baby. Nuts! The baby's fine, I'm fine. You go off and play and...
Hardly, Sarah.
Rourke stood up, his attention seemingly riveted to a point in space.
I haven't played in so long.
He let the sentence hang. She crossed the room and put her arms around his neck.
I love you. I want to be with you.
He circled his arms around her, and she felt his breath against her cheek, her neck, her hair.
That was all I ever wanted. Don't you realize that after all this time?
Sarah Rourke realized she hadn't. He held her so tight she thought she'd faint. Though he was so like his father, John, Sarah still remembered Michael as helpless and fragile. Perhaps she could not quite see Michael as she saw her husband, but John, she was sure, had never been quite helpless, nor ever fragile. Did John's mother yell at him, complain he hadn't cleaned his room or taken out the garbage? Had he ever neglected a responsibility, shirked a task? It was hard to imagine him anything less than he was now. John concluded a quick discussion with the chairman, then clasped the man's hand and walked on. She watched him. He was all in black, a combination of the mid-wake battle dress utilities and things from New Germany. His black pants bloused over the tops of his shiny black combat boots. He wore a black knit shirt open at the throat, a jacket of the same material as the pants, waist length, fully open. At his waist, he wore a wide black leather belt, then a matching belt and gleaming black leather full-flap holster slung at his right hip, carrying his .44 Magnum revolver. John stopped, exchanged a few quick words with Colonel Mann, shook hands, and walked toward her. The helicopter's rotor blades sliced the air with a steady, almost sensuous sound. He took her in his arms, and she closed her eyes and pretended the moment would never end. A second German helicopter gunship joined them, flying their wing until they crossed the open water to the far western side, a small German-Chinese base established there near where Vladimir Karamazov once set his field headquarters. There, the gunship would be fitted with auxiliary fuel pods, additional armament, and the floats that would allow it to land on the water's surface. A German pilot flew the aircraft. Rourke took the brief time this would afford him to rest. Once they set out on their trip, John would be the only pilot, but intended to teach Paul how to control the craft well enough that the younger man could keep it airborne. John Rourke closed his eyes. Sleep would come fast and end too soon. He could still see Sarah, beautiful and ridiculous-looking in her BDUs and combat boots. He could see her looking after the gunship long after it was airborne. Eventually, though, she was gone. He knew she could see the gunship as only a dark speck on the horizon. John remembered the conversation with Michael when they rode on horseback to the ridge and came up behind the Mongols waiting in ambush for Paul, Maria, Prokopyev, and Han Lu Chen. Michael wanted frank answers concerning Natalia. John gave his son no frank answers at all. Rourke kept his eyes closed. In his mind, he saw Natalia's eyes, their surreal blue. Would her eyes ever see the world as it really was again? Or was she destined to be a prisoner within her mind for the rest of her life? A prisoner in a cell he helped create. Rourke opened his eyes. Dreaming was something that ceased for him after the sleep. But there was always a chance dreaming might return. John Rourke knew the face that would be in his nightmare if he risked sleep. The gunship was surrounded by cloud cover now, and John Rourke looked out of the helicopter, watching the wispy grayness. Everywhere, gunships rose into the air like gigantic black insects leaving some feast of carrion. Vasily Prokopyev reined in the Mongol horse he rode, the beast barely able to stand properly.
Why did I think that?
Steam issued from Vasily Prokopyev's lips as he exhaled.
Death.
It was the occupation he trained for since boyhood. Inspired by the heroic accounts of the hero marshal, Vladimir Karamazov, the heroic struggle of the hero marshal against the evil forces of capitalism, and the CIA assassin John Rourke, what was the CIA again? Was it not, in its way, like the KGB? Was the KGB intrinsically evil? Then was the CIA? John Rourke was not evil. Michael Rourke was a man to be counted on, trusted, a friend who saved Prokofiev's life. Few of the black machines were still on the ground in the valley stretching open before him. Two lightweight armored personnel carriers formed a wedge at the mouth of the valley, guarding access. A huge bonfire licked the sky at the north end of the valley, consuming fuel tanks in ferocious eruptions. He realized that damaged vehicles or equipment that could not be taken away were being burned. He dug in his heels. The animal shuddered under him, but didn't move. Prokofiev dismounted. He studied the horse's head for a moment. Weariness filled its eyes. He set to uncinching and removing the saddle. A feed bag hung on the saddle lying in the snow near Prokofiev's feet. He took the bag, slashed it open with a Chinese bayonet, then set it on the ground where the animal could bend to it easily. With the saddle blanket, he rubbed the animal down, wiping off its sweat. He was not a horseman, but realized that leaving the animal lathered in the freezing temperatures would not be good. Having done all he could, he clapped the animal on the neck and strode through the snow, down along the defile toward the valley entrance. Little remained of his uniform, little visible anyway, beneath the Mongol outer garments he wore to keep warm. But these were his men, his elite corps. They would know him. He cast aside the inferior bayonet. There were finely made Soviet knives available to officers of his rank. It would be easy enough to get hold of one, have the knife dispatched to him from the stores of such things held in reserve for the elite corps. Prokofiev reviewed what he would tell the comrade colonel, who commanded the armies of the Soviet now since the murder. Prokofiev stopped. In the distance, hatches of one of the armored personnel carriers opened. He assumed he was recognized. John Rourke was not a murderer. Of course, the traitorous Major Tyamarovna, once wife of the hero marshal, she was the one who murdered the hero marshal. Prokofiev resumed walking. He considered two versions of the truth. The one he had been told, the one he had experienced. It was hard to imagine, for example, that Dr. Rourke, the father of Michael Rourke, would have criminally conspired with any woman to murder her husband. Vasily Prokofiev realized there was some error. After all, Comrade Colonel Antonovich had not witnessed the slaying of the hero marshal. Was there devious work afoot? Perhaps a conspiracy among those who witnessed the hero marshal's death? It was impossible to imagine Dr. Rourke and this female major waiting in ambush for the hero marshal, giving him no chance to defend himself, murdering him when he surrendered for the sake of his men, and then murdering his men as well.
I must tell the colonel of these discrepancies. Perhaps the entire new offensive is based on misinformation.
The man Hanlu Chen, by any standard, was brave. Paul Rubinstein, a Jew, was heroic beyond measure. Since Prokofiev first entered school, he learned that Jews were at times capable of singular intellectual achievement, but were a cowardly race, now exterminated. How then, unless the man Rubinstein was an ethnic anomaly, was this possible? And would a man such as Dr. Rourke, or Michael Rourke, allow a daughter or sister to marry someone who was all but subhuman? Certainly not. Had other Jews been like Paul Rubinstein? If they were, then why had he been taught his other lessons? No one would call out that he should halt, so Prokofiev halted of his own accord before the men guarding the valley entrance opened fire. They would be under orders to do so.
Comrades! It is Major Prokofiev! Do not shoot!
He walked toward them, with his hands outstretched, palms open. This was a withdrawal, obviously. But was it a withdrawal because the second Chinese city essentially no longer exists? Or had the plans for the offensive changed?
How goes the offensive, comrades?
If they told him what they thought was true, would it be true? It was impossible for Bjorn Rolvag to communicate with them effectively because they had no command of the language. He was able, by sheer force of concentration only, to make something from their words, searching for every possible similarity between their language and his, however remote or unlikely. Rolvag sat up in bed and collected his thoughts while they merely watched him. Michael Rourke, Annie's brother, and the German woman, Dr. Maria Leuden, who was an archaeologist, mentioned Lidwelded Island, the Soviets, and performed ludicrous pantomimes of men fighting in battle. It seemed likely that Lidwelded Island had been invaded. He had asked about Annie Rubinstein, and they seemed to understand him well enough that they tried to answer. He got the impression, again by word association and through their pantomime, that Annie might be lost and in some danger. Somehow, Bjorn and Annie Rubinstein understood each other well enough that, despite words, the understanding was genuine, clear. The Russian woman, Natalia Temirovna, was the only one of them who could actually converse with him because she spoke so many languages so well that they made do and talked. The Russian woman, with her pretty, sad blue eyes. Was she with Annie and lost? Or lost and in danger on her own? Bjorn Rolvag could not be sure. He watched their eyes watching his eyes. He formed the few English words as carefully as he could for them so they would understand.
Rolvag, does go Lidwelded Island, Michael. Rolvag, does good.
His head still ached at times, but he was confident that he was healing. Michael started to say something, and, tired, Rolvag merely repeated for them.
Rolvag, does go Lidwelded Island.
That should be clear enough for anyone to understand, he reasoned. The party chairman stood in the elevator beside Antonovich, whose gaze focused on the chairman's scientific advisor, Svetlana Alexova. She was beyond pretty. Her blonde hair sat sternly arranged in a bun at the nape of her neck, her long, graceful neck. Her mouth, devoid of lipstick, full and inviting. Her eyes, blue, were clear, purposeful. Then he heard her voice.
Comrade Chairman, the credit for the discovery belongs to Comrade Dr. Kulienkov. He is a young man, a member of my scientific team that has been developing the particle beam systems for military applications.
Your leadership doubtlessly inspired Kulienkov, Comrade Doctor.
She turned quickly and looked at him, the corners of her mouth dimpling with a quick, genuine-looking smile.
Thank you, Comrade Marshall.
He did not correct her, because he did not wish to. Technically, although he wore Colonel's rank, he was Chief Marshal of the Soviet Union. He supposed it was false modesty not to wear his proper rank, after all. The elevator stopped.
How many floors, Comrade Doctor, have we descended?
We are 7 levels below the main level of the city, Comrade Marshall. The entire level is devoted to military research. For our testing purposes, there is access to the summit of the mountain above by means of small conveyors and 2 large industrial lifts.
She smiled again as she thrust her hands into the pockets of her white lab coat. The action accentuated the neatness of her figure.
It is quite a ride, Comrade Marshall, on the conveyors. More than a mile in total darkness except for the lights built into the belt itself. All within what appears to be a seamless tube of transparent high-density polymers. The tube was inserted from the top of the borehole, then heat-welded by robotized tract welders, their work controlled by remote video cameras. It is quite the engineering marvel. As a scientist, I have always respected the skills of the engineer. Without such skills, science would be nothing more than a curiosity and novelty. There could be no practical application.
They walked along a gleaming corridor, a tunnel, Antonovich presumed. At its farthest end stood a set of massive double doors. Parked along the corridor wall were 3 electric carts. Dr. Alexeva gestured toward one of them. The comrade chairman nodded. Breaking the silence, he began when Antonovich first accompanied him from party headquarters.
You told me, Comrade Marshal Antonovich, that you need troops. Here, you will find that you will not need troops.
They seated themselves in the cart, Dr. Alexeva at the controls.
What is it that you intend to show me, Comrade Sherman?
The future of Soviet power.
Antonovich turned and faced forward. He sat beside Dr. Alexeva, and he savored the experience. They passed through a set of double doors, attended by security guards, and entered a short corridor. Set into the wall of the corridor stood a bank of elevators. At the other end stood another set of double doors, controlled by electronic security. Passing through the second set of doors, they entered the laboratory complex. It was all one giant laboratory the size of some huge stadium, a kilometer square at least. The individual laboratories were arranged without any walls separating them for the most part.
All personnel live on the level above us with complete educational, recreational, medical, and cultural facilities at their disposal, Comrade Marshall. Their elevator keys only work in the second lift battery, which you saw between the sets of security doors. Without special authorization, they are not allowed beyond the second set of doors. We have found that an atmosphere of scientific openness, where one team knows the work of the other, is best for rapid progress. Yet the security difficulties such a system creates are monumental, hence the system used here. You may have noticed a few of the laboratories are walled. This is not for secrecy, but for reasons related directly to the nature of the work.
The electric cart stopped near the center of the complex, surrounded by the hum of equipment, whiffs of chemical odors, and conversation. He stepped down, offered to help Dr. Alexeva. She was already out of the cart.
This is what I would never show to our so-called hero Marshall, comrade. He would have seen the work going on here and been obsessed with possessing it. Who knows whether spies brought him some information of this. Might yet have been for this reason he launched his savage attack against the underground city with gas.
Then why do you show me this, comrade chairman?
Antonovich riveted his gaze on the chairman's impassive face, the drooping lids, the drooping jowls, the impression almost of a face molded in wax and then partially melted.
I have no choice, Antonovich. You wish peace through victory. You wish to avoid the use of nuclear weapons. And so do I. Here is the way.
Dr. Alexeva waited a respectful distance away. The comrade chairman's face brightened as he turned toward her.
Show him everything. I shall be waiting in your office, comrade doctor.
Yes, comrade chairman.
Antonovich watched the comrade chairman climb back into the electric cart, then drive off. After a moment, he felt Dr. Alexeva at his side.
Much work has been done here, comrade Marshall. It is now at your disposal to lead the forces of the Soviet people to victory, to our finest hour.
Antonovich turned and looked at her.
Yes, comrade doctor.
He was reminded of the Judeo-Christian myth concerning the Garden of Eden. He wondered vaguely whether the comrade chairman or the beautiful comrade doctor had the role of the snake, because he was about to be given all the forbidden fruit he could ever want. Yuri Kulienkov was indeed quite young, no more than 25.
I have considerable difficulty, Comrade Marshall, talking about things in a way that is not scientific. I apologize, Comrade Marshall.
You have nothing to apologize for, Comrade Dr. Kulienkov. Genius requires no apology. I will confess that I know very little of science.
Antonovich caught the reaction in Dr. Alexeva's eyes, favorable. Kulienkov was a skinny man, the ravages of adolescence still visible in a few pockmarks on his cheeks and forehead, shoulders hunched beneath his lab coat as he bent over something that looked like a combination of a gun and a radio set at the side of a huge fish tank. Were signals crossed? Wasn't Kulienkov told to show him something to do with the advancements in particle beam weaponry?
This came about by accident, Comrade Marshall. And without Comrade Dr. Alexeva's policy of openness, it would have never been possible.
Yuri looked over his shoulder and smiled at her, his glasses slipping a little, dark hair in his eyes. Did Kulienkov have a crush on his superior? Dr. Alexeva smiled back at him.
Thank you, Kulienkov.
I knew, of course, that there was an important project concerning communications under the sea. I knew that various frequency ranges were being tried, that we could use a conventional laser systems, but only as part of an already established system of links. So I asked myself how it might be if a conventional laser were to ride as a passenger on a particle beam.
As the hum of the beam increased, Antonovich involuntarily stepped back across the floor of the laboratory, away from the now glowing apparatus.
It was simple. Once the theory was developed, really, this is simply a much modified form of the plasma-energized particle beam system developed for armored vehicles.
Antonovich looked at Dr. Alexeva.
A particle beam weapon that does not require something the size of a mountain for its energy source.
She smiled, said nothing.
It is merely a matter of firing at reduced charge levels, of course, and aiming the laser beam where everyone wishes to, like this.
Kulyenkov pulled a microphone to his lips as he flipped a switch. The water along the center of the tank seemed to instantly boil, but in a straight line. Steam rose from the tank in a huge cloud. At the far end of the tank was a conventional speaker.
To his ability, to each according to his need.
The quote was from Karl Marx, but Antonovich was reminded more of Buck Rogers.
Now that we will be able to communicate through the water successfully, it will be possible to contact Soviet forces under the sea. The technological breakthroughs have enabled us to pursue the alliance, and if necessary, should no alliance result, will enable us to vanquish these forces, should such become necessary.
The comrade chairman smoked a cigarette, leaned back in Dr. Alexeva's chair, and placed his feet on her desk. Antonovich thought that, had the chairman been smoking a fat cigar, he would have made the perfect caricature of a rich capitalist. They excluded Dr. Alexeva from this meeting. Only the two men sat in the soundproof office. Except for the hiss of air through two air conditioning vents, there was no noise beyond their breathing and their conversation.
I am reminded of the so-called SETI programs I have read of.
Search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Yes, Comrade Marshall. The SETI programs fired radio signals into the void of the cosmos. We will fire signals into the void of the deep.
Antonovich didn't really consider the ocean a void, in fact just the opposite, but refrained from correcting the comrade chairman.
And, since we know the approximate area in which to search, it should be a matter of days, a few weeks at the most, before contact is made.
Forgive me, comrade chairman, but what if our Soviet brothers beneath the ocean's surface do not choose to respond?
The message will be such that they will have no choice. I intend to inform them that there is a substantial possibility that if they do not act at once, the Germans, who are allies of our other enemies, will launch a nuclear missile which will so totally destroy the atmosphere that the precious ocean will be vaporized around them.
Antonovich leaned forward, sitting at the edge of his chair.
But, Comrade Sherman...
I am merely extrapolating from the facts. Your own high-altitude surveillance confirms that it is likely the Germans are perfecting a nuclear warhead to possibly use against us. You must admit.
His drooping, wrinkled face smiled.
They will be intrigued by this message, our Soviet brothers,
Yes, Comrade Chairman.
If we can forge an alliance, so be it. If not, we shall destroy them with our particle beam weapons. Once they respond, we shall know their exact location beneath the ocean surface, each signal computer monitored, of course.
The chairman smiled again as he shifted his feet from the corner of the desk and looked Antonovich in the eye.
We have become invincible, Comrade Marshall.
Yes, invincible.
The composite video display dominating the forward bulkhead was set for forward view and revealed shoals some 500 yards ahead of the Reagan along its present course. Sebastian's long fingers spread across the illuminated plotting board at the heart of the control station.
Navigation 10 degrees left rudder and hold it there.
Lieutenant Junior Grade Loreen Bowman carried out the command.
Shift into 10 degrees left rudder, Captain.
Darkwood swung his chair right.
Communications, are you picking up anything, Lieutenant?
Just some low-frequency noise, Captain. It could be electronic stuff that's out of tune and crept into the wrong bands. I can't make anything out of it at all, sir.
Very good, Lieutenant Mott. Advise me if there's any change.
Aye, sir.
Darkwood rotated his chair to face forward again. The shoals more pronounced now on the video display.
Bring that rudder amidships again, Helm.
Captain, I'd advise blowing 15% air to the starboard tanks.
Darkwood's eyes flickered from the video screen to Lieutenant Commander T.J. Sebastian's face.
Order the blow, Mr. Sebastian, and alert the crew we'll be running out of trim.
Aye, Captain. Blowing 15% negative buoyant starboard tanks.
Sebastian reached for his microphone.
Now hear this. This is the first officer speaking. Until further notice, secure to run 15% off trim to port.
Sebastian put down the microphone.
Navigation. Blow 15% air to starboard tanks and hold.
Sebastian turned to the engineering station.
Commander Hartnett, please advise me should there be any change in reactor status.
Hartnett nodded.
I will advise you, Mr. Sebastian.
Darkwood's command chair was gyroscopically balanced and automatically adjusted 15 degrees of attitude toward starboard. Captain Darkwood had traveled to Iwo Jima once before for one of the few surface survival classes. It was more years ago than he wanted to remember, when he was a student at the Naval Academy. He was one of five cadets allowed to stand on the bridge while the skipper of the submarine that brought them there navigated the inlet. There were charts, of course, that showed the depths and bottom contours, but it was a matter of pride in the submarine service that you didn't scrape the bottom with your hull. Plus, since this was an unauthorized, unannounced visit to the island, there was always the possibility that some overzealous person working with the island defenses might shoot first and ask questions afterward.
Lieutenant Mott.
Aye, Captain.
Send this for me on all standard defense frequencies using the Sigma 3 code. Compliments to Colonel P.Q. Armbruster, commanding. This is the United States attack submarine Ronald Wilson Reagan. We are entering through the inlet without orders because of an emergency security situation. We will surface at the approximate center of the lagoon.
Darkwood checked the face of the dual display Steinmetz on his left wrist.
We will surface at the approximate center of the lagoon at precisely 0900 hours. I anticipate you will have security personnel in the vicinity to verify identification. Signed, Darkwood, Captain, Commanding USS Reagan. If you got it all, there's no need to read it back, Andy.
Aye, sir. I got it.
Send it once, Lieutenant.
Darkwood turned away. The video display's forward view revealed the shoal was receding to starboard.
Mr. Sebastian, correct this uncomfortable list to port. I think we're safe enough now if we surface to periscope depth and resume normal speed while keeping a good eye on the bottom.
Aye, Captain. Helm, equalize the blow. Bring us up to periscope depth and adjust present speed to all ahead 2/3.
Aye, Mr. Sebastian. Adjusting to periscope depth.
Maintain present course, Mr. Sebastian, unless you see fit to do otherwise.
Aye, Captain. Maintaining present course and speed.
Sebastian picked up his microphone again.
This is the first officer speaking, secure from the previously mentioned navigational correction.
Jason Darkwood just looked at his first officer as he stood. He'd never heard one like that before. He moved aft, Seaman First Class Tagachi at the periscope controls.
Morris, run her up for me when we reach periscope depth.
Aye, Captain. We're gonna breathe real air, Captain?
Sure, Leaf. If we have time, I suppose. But I understand breathing real air can be hazardous to your health. I had a cough for days afterward the last time I did.
Really, sir?
Right.
Darkwood clapped Tagachi on the shoulder. As the vessel reached periscope depth, Morris Tagachi activated the periscope controls. Darkwood stepped to the periscope as the handles lowered. Each time he used either this or the attack periscope, he unfailingly thought of the centuries-old movies he had seen of the early days of submarining. The slightly grizzled, stubble-faced captain ordered up periscope and snapped down the handles from the dully gleaming brass tube, his face sweating as he crouched to peer through the tube. With the periscope aboard the Reagan, there was no need to crouch because they were adjustable to various height levels instantly. There was no reason to sweat unless one was working out in the gymnasium. Granted, it wasn't that large. Wearing a beard, as long as it was in regs, was acceptable, but never stubble. He'd always secretly wondered how the Navy Department expected someone to grow a beard within regs without growing through the stubble stage first. Darkwood worked the buttons for focus as he looked into the periscope, surveying the lagoon as they entered. He felt almost like Captain Nemo returning to the island that was the seat of his anguish. But on this island were fellow officers and men in the service of Midwake, fellow Americans. And...
Sebastian, battle stations, get us out of here now! Down periscope!
Darkwood pushed past Seaman First Class Tagachi, sprinting toward the command chair, taking the three steps down to the control and navigation level in a jump, the Reagan already beginning to rock under him.
Now hear this! Battle stations! Say again, battle stations! This is not a drill!
Sebastian threw down the microphone.
Helm, hard right rudder. All back, blow air. Engineering, reactor status. Helm, bring her about, faster. Engineering, that reactor status.
Both port and starboard reactors online and running smooth, Mr. Sebastian.
Darkwood stared at the video display as though he were looking through some huge window. On the beach, at the far side of the lagoon, he saw Russian troops, but no sign of their submarine, and that was what frightened him.
Helm, are we about yet?
We're coming about now, Captain. In 5, 4, 3, 2, 1... We are about, Captain.
Rudder amidships, bring us to half-flank speed.
Darkwood moved to the illuminated plotting table beside Sebastian.
Communications, bring up aft projection on the screen.
Aye, Captain. You have aft projection.
Darkwood turned to the screen. The picture changed instantly. There was nothing suspicious within visual range.
Communications, give me split-screen imaging fore and aft.
Split-screen imaging now, Captain, as indicated.
The video display was now evenly divided between fore and aft views, and to prevent a panicked captain from making some critical mistake, the words fore and aft flashed on and off on their appropriate screens. Darkwood focused his attention on the illuminated plotting board. The Reagan was into the inlet channel. Sebastian had done his work well, as had the navigator, Lorene Bowman. Darkwood made a mental note to mention this in the log.
Engineering, be ready for overdrive as soon as we clear the channel.
Aye, Captain.
They were entering the portion of the channel guarded by shoals.
Helm, give me a slow blow to 70% negative buoyancy on port side tanks and 85% on starboard proportionately. Be ready to terminate the blow on my signal.
Aye, Captain. Starting the blow now.
Warfare status, Lieutenant Walensky.
Aye, Captain. Torpedo tubes fore and aft loaded and operational with HEIS, Captain.
Stand by, Louise. Communications, get on the usual Soviet operational frequencies.
I'm already monitoring, Captain. They've seen us. Nobody's talking about it. Who's out there, Captain?
Darkwood grabbed Sebastian's microphone from the hangar over the table.
This is the captain speaking. The island of Iwo Jima is supposed to be a top-secret American training center for surface warfare operations. While approaching the island just upon entering the lagoon, I viewed a significant force of personnel in Soviet Marine Spetsnaz uniforms and full battle gear. Given that visual, I elected to run. This could have been an exercise using enemy uniforms and equipment. However, if it isn't, we're in potentially deep trouble because they wouldn't be here without one of their island classers, and we all know how much fun island classers can be. So stand by. I'll keep you informed, and keep sharpening those battle stations. Captain out.
He racked the microphone.
Lieutenant Kelly, sonar, anything I should worry about?
Not yet, Captain.
Keep me informed.
Aye, Captain.
He'd made a critical tactical error, something he also intended to note in his log in the hopes of preventing some other captain from doing the same thing someday. Pulling into an American base, assuming only American personnel would be monitoring his short-range communications.
Communications, anything?
Not a word, Captain.
Keep monitoring.
They were listing again, and the deck didn't compensate like his chair did. As he eyed the split video image, he turned to Sebastian.
If you have any brilliant insights, Commander Sebastian, now's not the time to withhold them.
Captain, it seems to me that an analysis of the details suggests why we have not been picked up. If an island-class submarine isn't waiting for us when we exit the channel, my theory will likely be correct.
Do we have to use that as the acid test?
It would appear that either the personnel you saw in Marine Spetsnaz Black were engaged in a realistic training exercise, in which case we will merely be late for our rendezvous, or more likely, since Lieutenant Mott has not received a reply to your Sigma code greeting, there was no one to receive it, or everyone was too busy to respond, or in fear of their communications being monitored. That leads me to infer that the island is under attack. There is ample supporting evidence, however circumstantial, to support such a hypothesis. Marine Spetsnaz communications equipment of the standard issue type we are aware of is not designed to, nor is it ordinarily capable of, intercepting short-range signals in the range used by our submarines. If an island-class submarine were surfaced or submerged on the opposite side of an island such as Iwo Jima, it is doubtful in the extreme that said vessel would have intercepted our communications or our running noise, Captain.
Then they don't know we're here.
Unless an island-class vessel is waiting for us, that seems reasonable to assume based on current data.
Darkwood clapped Sebastian on the back. Darkwood pulled down the microphone again.
This is the captain speaking. Captain Aldridge and Lieutenant Stanhope to the bridge on the double.
He looked at Sebastian as he racked the microphone.
If you're right, we're going to have to play this close to the vest, Sebastian. What's the nearest American vessel you know of?
Commander Pilgrim's ship, the Wayne, Captain.
Darkwood nodded. Walter Pilgrim was a good man under fire, and the John Wayne was a good vessel.
All right. Can't risk trying to contact the Wayne. Yet. Plot their approximate position as soon as we're out of here and in deep water. Then update the plot so we'll have an idea how close some assistance might be if it gets that far.
They were nearly out of the channel, past the shoals.
Helm, right us.
Aye, Captain. Right in the helm.
Darkwood's fingers were too busy at the plotting table to keep them crossed, but they were crossed in spirit.
I can help you. I've had a lot of first aid experience and worked with my parents. They shared a lot of their medical know-how with me.
Margaret Barrow looked at Annie Rourke Rubenstein as she belted a lab coat over her hospital gown with a little over 2 feet of dental floss.
All right. Can you check syringes? They're like the ones in your day, more or less.
I'll fake it.
Your day.
She went to the cabinet Margaret Barrow gestured toward. Annie realized, of course, she was a living, breathing, walking, and talking anachronism.
And at first chance you get in my office, I've got some extra clothes. In case there's a bleeder and I zig when I should have zagged. Just take the rank insignia off the collar, okay?
Okay.
She began to check the syringes. Darkwood sat in his command chair. There had been no island-class submarine waiting for them, and they were hiding now well off the coast of Iwo Jima in deep water, still at battle stations. In a ragged semicircle between his chair and the steps stood Sam Aldridge, Tom Stanhope, and Sebastian.
I'm betting Sebastian's right, gentlemen. That means we've got a bunch of our GIs in shit up to their elbows back there on Iwo Jima. And aboard the Reagan, we've got Dr. Rourke's daughter, a German officer, and Major Chemerovna. The two women are potentially bargaining chips our garden variety Soviet enemies could use as a lure to draw in the Soviet forces on the surface. An alliance like that could mean the end for all of us. There's one clear course of action, and that's our only chance. Sebastian?
Yes, Jason?
You'll take the Reagan and make best possible speed toward Midwake. Once you're out of range of the island classer our Marine Spetsnaz friends came from, attempt to contact the Wayne. Notify them of the situation and ask them to come to our aid. Mr. Stanhope.
Sir.
Lieutenant, you'll be in charge of security aboard the Reagan, and that means looking after our passengers. If anything happens, they go before the women and children. Got me?
Yes, sir.
Good. Sam, you and I are taking the majority of the Marine security detail and heading for Iwo Jima. No sense attacking some damned island class with bare hands and Bowie knives. We hit the side of the island where the lagoon is on the assumption that some of our guys are still going to be operational. The plan's loose, but the crux of the whole thing is that we win. You can fill in the blanks however you wish.
Jeez, Jace.
Yeah, I knew you'd love it.
Darkwood looked at Sebastian.
I'll expect you back here for us as quick as you can get our charges to Midwake, Sebastian. And don't forget about helping Mrs. Rubinstein to contact her father and her husband. There's got to be some way of doing it. Knowing Dr. Rourke, he'll be looking for her in Major Chemerovna.
Yes, Captain.
I want you to get us within range of the island. I'm officially transferring to you temporary command of the Reagan as of...
Darkwood looked at the Steinmetz.
As of 0952 hours. And Captain Aldridge and Lieutenant Stanhope witness that. I'll make certain the log reflects that. God bless us all.
Amen to that.
Svetlana Alexeva's office was at once Spartan and luxurious, elegant in its austerity. The desk was unadorned, but was of real wood, something almost impossible to obtain within the underground city. The wristwatch she wore was the most expensive brand. Her clothes, tailored, functional, also of the finest fabrics. He had known many women of the underground city. This one dressed like the mistress of a commissar.
This is the original prototype of the plasma-powered particle beam gun. It has been successfully tested on armored vehicles, helicopters, and bipod mounted as a replacement for the conventional caseless machine gun in the current inventory.
She was beautiful. Nikolai Antonovich was having a hard time concentrating on anything else but that fact.
How many and how fast, Comrade Dr. Alexeva?
At present, Comrade Marshall, the weapons must be calibrated by hand, and this requires considerable testing. Should one of these overload, it will, of course, explode. We have approximately 100 of the weapons in operational order. None of these the model designed to replace the machine gun. The power packs are still a difficulty, but my people are working on it in three shifts throughout each 24-hour period. The solution is forthcoming, I assure you. More of the weapons are being produced daily, and the calibration process is even now being streamlined to meet full production needs.
He recalled the Americanism about clouds and silver linings. Here was the opposite case, certainly.
These 100 weapons available to mount on helicopters and armored vehicles, they are fully operational and can be relied upon thoroughly?
That is the only way they can leave here, Comrade Marshall. I have full confidence in them.
Where are they?
Ready for you to examine, Comrade Marshall.
Tonight?
If you wish.
She averted her eyes. He had known Karamazov long enough to recognize deceit and treachery. He knew she was practicing both, and decided he would enjoy it.
Tell me, Comrade Doctor, just how deep are your feelings, loyalty to the state?
There is nothing I would not do, Comrade Marshall.
Svetlana, it is one of the most beautiful of names for a woman. May I call you by your first name? Of course, only when we are alone.
I am honored, Comrade Marshall.
He doubted the chief science advisor to the Soviet government was all that terribly honored at the prospect of having a soldier's boots beside her bed. He was being courted, and not by Svetlana Alexeva. He reached out his right hand and closed it over her hand.
Svetlana, your beauty has captivated me, but you must know that. It must be obvious.
Comrade Marshall, I...
You are overwhelmed.
He nodded, smiling. It was evident that the chairman wanted him happy, wanted him eager to serve the Soviet interest. And Comrade Dr. Alexeva was to ensure that loyalty, that enthusiasm. There was no need to provide him with some added incentive to serve the Soviet people. It was his life. He smiled. Comrade Dr. Svetlana Alexeva did not know that. And she, too, was willing to serve the Soviet interest.
You have captured my heart, Svetlana. It is very hard out there, fighting constantly. One loses sight of what ordinary humanity must be like. The loneliness is intolerable.
He had used that speech several times in the past, and often wondered why some intelligent woman did not simply laugh at him when he used it. Certainly this woman should laugh. She did not.
I want to possess you, Svetlana.
Yes, Comrade Marshall.
He stood, walked to her desk. She stood. She took a step nearer to him. There was little choice, really. Should he not attempt to seduce her, the comrade chairman might suspect disloyalty or homosexuality. In either case, disaster. And she was so very beautiful. He did not ask if she had a health certificate. She obviously did, as did he.
Do you stay where the other scientist stays, Svetlana?
I have a room there, of course. But I find my apartment in the city more conducive to thought.
I would like to see it very much. Might I do that? See it?
Yes, Comrade Marshall.
Nikolai, Svetlana. Nikolai.
He held her hand more tightly. The late morning meetings would have to wait, as would be expected.